Tonight the topic is sports and American values, and it occurs to me that a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Solzhenitsyn's critique of American and Western society, that more of us probably were distracted by Pete Rose's streak at the time than we were with the particulars of Solzhenitsyn's comments at the Harvard commencement address. And yet, I think all of us recognize, obviously, that there are a good number of criticisms of sports in this country at this time that are unsettling, especially when we think of competitive and professional sports, that it's become too big a business, that it's too big of a budget item in our public education system, that it places maybe too big of a demand on our time, not so much as participants, but as spectators and as followers in the news. It's a peculiar society, I suppose, that devotes as much time to the weather and sports roundup each night on the evening news as it does to global affairs. I don't know if that's true in other countries.
Yeah. Japan is more on sports than America.
Probably.
Yeah. What we saw.
There is the uneasy feeling that perhaps the big business of sports in this country is perhaps too big a defender of those American values that run counter to those commitments that we have as Christians. And yet also, a lot of us would say that it's a kind of necessary and harmless diversion from the personal and public and even global hassles that we do concern ourselves with daily. Some would argue even that it's an inspiration to fitness, indirectly, if not directly always, that it's an inculcator of practical values, perhaps good business values, of moral values, even spiritual values, and some would argue patriotic values. I suppose at least the half times of the Super Bowl should provide that function. and you know, we could go on, and I assume that Erling Jorstad will do that as he presents at least some perspective on those that have found some lasting and profound, significant and perhaps even profound importances in sports in America. And following his comments, Walt Bowman will raise then some further questions about the role of sports and American values. And then immediately following that, I thought again tonight we would try meeting and gathering in small groups of six or eight at the most, and just share your own views and reactions either to what these gentlemen have set forth or your own additional ideas and perspectives. And we'll do that not as long as we did the other night when we dealt with public education, say at most 15 minutes. And then gather again together and ask that, say, one person from the group can make a few comments about the kind of conversation that went on, not necessarily trying to reconcile views at all, but instead, I hope, expressing very briefly just the kinds of comments and if there are any disagreements that came up in your discussion. And then we'll simply continue our conversation from there until about 10 o'clock. I promise, as opposed to my performance last night, that I will recess it at 10, whoever or whatever is being said, and take a brief break then. And then those who want to continue will continue until about 10:30 or so. So, Erling,
okay.
You have your cheerleading squad.
I'm glad we're sitting.
Jets.
I was going to say, I'm glad we're sitting down, because it wouldn't be a fair match if I stood up. You know, and we all stood up. I was reminded, because I'm going to talk about some of the symbolism and other things inherent in sports, and I was mentioning this to Walt before, that just last fall, our first stop on our Asian semester was in Japan, and it was time for the national samurai wrestler showdown, or whatever they call it. And our coordinator was an American missionary, maybe some of you know him, maybe I'll see Lyle Larson, who had been there 17 years, and all during the day he was sort of what we expected, and at night we sat down in where we were in the hotel and watching the television, and he went absolutely bananas over this, and I watched these big hulks come out and bounce around and strut and throw salt over their shoulder, and to do two or three other things. And we had another kid there too who was a volunteer English teacher in one of the schools through the ALC, and he thought it was the most exciting, you know, thing he had ever seen. And began to realize that it was simply more than just sort of naked aggression at work here, although they were almost naked, I mean, in the other way too, if you've seen them. It's really quite a kind of remarkable thing. But that aside, I only want to present a few rather disjointed remarks here to, about the subject, and draw from two sources. When I presented this last week as a lecture, I drew almost exclusively from Michael Novak's book, The Joy of Sports, and I want to take a little bit from there tonight, but also bring in some other material which I found, and read through some of that, and I think that'll speak for itself, and simply let it go at that. I think I would agree with quite a bit of what Novak says, and what the other author says here is, especially about football as a metaphor for American life. And then, you know, I don't know what Walt is going to say, and be glad to you know, go on with this. Basically, what Michael Novak is arguing is that sports is more than entertainment. It's more than a release or an outlet for aggression. It's more than role-playing that so many people associated with. And he argues that if we are to understand ourselves, if we understand ourselves as Americans, if we are to understand ourselves as a people, and if we to do these things, we must understand that sports is more than entertainment. It's more than competition. It's more than status, you know, mobility, and this sort of thing in this country. But we should look at sports as a liturgical, even he would say in a natural sense, not a revealed sense, in a natural sense as a form of religious expression in this particular country, as one expression, organized expression of American life. And I'll just read his thesis here. The basic reality of all human life is play, games, sport. These are the realities from which the basic metaphors that all that is important in the rest of life are drawn. Work, politics, and history are the illusory, misleading, false world. Being, beauty, truth, excellence, transcendence. These words grown in the soil of play, wither in the sand of work. Art, prayer, worship, love, civilization. These thrive in the field of play. Play belongs to the kingdom of end, work to the kingdom of means. Barbarians play in order to work, the civilized work in order to play. And then he has something here that I was very impressed with, that I wanted to read. He probably gets carried away a little bit with the prose on this, but he's talking about after going through many of the different things, he says this: if I had one single reason for my love of sports, it would be this. I love the tests of the human spirit. I love to see defeated teams refuse to die. I love to see impossible odds confronted. I love to see impossible dares accepted. I love to see the incredible grace lavished on simple plays, the simple flashing beauty of perfect form. But even more, I love to see the heart that refuses to give in, refuses to panic, seizes opportunities, slips through defenses, exerts itself far beyond capacity, forges momentarily of its bodily habitat an instrument of almost perfect will. Perhaps it is a form of Slavic masochism, and he's of Slavic descent, but for all my life I have never known such thoroughly penetrating joys as playing with an inspired team against a team we recognized from the beginning had every reason to beat us. I love it when the other side is winning and there are only moments left. I love it when it would be reasonable to be reconciled to defeat, but one will not, cannot. I love it when a last set of calculated, reckless, free, and impassioned efforts is crowned with success. When I see others play that way, I am full of admiration, of gratitude. That is the way I believe the human race should live. When human beings actually accomplish it, it is for me as if the intentions of the Creator were suddenly limpid before our eyes, as though into the fiery heart of the Creator we had momentary insight. Which is some fairly, you know, heavy stuff on this. All right, now this will take a little while, and I'll skip one or two of these things, but I want to read an article from Christian Century written by Peter Heinig in 1974 on the philosophy of football. And it'll take a little while, but I think it'll make the point. Football is beautiful but meaningless. That is, it makes no sense, pragmatically speaking. Certainly nothing could be more absurd than to hire a small army of godlike brutes, gifted gifted with fantastic speed, strength, grace, and coordination to advance a leather ball down a gridiron. This very absurdity, however, intensifies the spectator's awareness of the beauty of the game. It is the old story of art for art's sake. Football is a sort of bone-crunching ballet with an improvised and unpredictable choreographer. Like dancers, players acquire a large repertory of movements, then spontaneously combine them as they go along. Football, in other words, is a succession of functionally perfect operations serving an unnecessary function. It is I don't even know what this word means. Autotelic. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Self-directed.
Self-directed.
It's own end. It is.
Yeah, it's autotelic. All right. The fans enjoy the power. Okay. The fans enjoy the power and precision of play for their own sake. Thus, we begin to see what anyone who has ever watched a good game knows, or at least obscurely senses, that football is better and more satisfying emotionally and intellectually than everyday life. The remaining points will justify this claim. Secondly, football, like life, is a fiercely fought contest, but with guaranteed justice. The spectator can follow the violent give and take, and with a happy thought that here, unlike the world outside, with its successful villains and downtrodden good guys, infractions are almost always caught and the referees almost always right. Here, if nowhere else, the wicked are penalized and the honest are not harassed. A football game gives us glimpses into utopia, a society where freedom flourishes under law. Here the police intervene only when necessary. The decisions of the judges are not only final but prompt and fair. Hulk and Titans submit their quarrels to a midget arbitrator and go along with the call. Finally, when in the real, if you've ever seen, you know, Buck Buchanan, you know what they're talking about. Finally, when in the real world the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, the inverted order of the pro draft selections establishes a world where the first are in fact last and the last first. The Seahawks have, you know, some distance to go that way. Okay. Like life, professional football is violence, but its roughness is only skin deep. No one ever dies and major injuries are infrequent. A team of medical attendants waits on the sidelines should anyone get hurt. There are bandages for sprains and oxygen for the man who has the wind knocked out of him. All this goes to fulfill an age-old masculine dream of a tremendous war with only incidental suffering. We can delight in the beauty of naked aggression without worrying about the consequences. 4. Compared with life, which is so often messy, chaotic, haphazard, and inconclusive, a football game is a masterpiece of logic and lucid organization. And I have to say, you know, the replay brings us out, or I don't know, in other cities, but on Monday night, the Vikings coach, Bud Grant, will have a replay of a perfect play. And, you know, it's a textbook thing that works. You see it in the textbook, you see a diagram, and then there'll be the rerun, and he'll do it 2 or 3 times, and by golly, you know, it works. And, you know, it's, all right, it is, the game itself, it is neatly divided into periods and halves and played on a precisely measured surface, on a precisely measured surface. There are rules to cover every possible eventuality. Everyone knows what he's doing or wants to do. Of course, this is one of the pleasures of observing any professional sport, a respite from the bunglers who run things in the world outside. owing to the shortness of the season, every game, even if it ends in a tie, has strategic importance. Then, too, as American life becomes more secularized, the Sunday pro games have a nice liturgical quality about them. A common rite performed before enthusiastic crowds. No empty pews here. All over the country in the tranquility of the Sabbath. In football, as in life, there is continual conflict, but in football it is arbitrary and artificial, and hence has no bite. Pro teams, quote, stand for nothing. Players are sold or traded, the leagues are reshuffled, etc. Thus, except for the hopelessly simple-minded, there is no serious commitment on the part of the fan and no ill feeling or bitterness. The players we know are playing for themselves and are not upholding any sentimental college reputation. In the game called game, there are no important issues at stake, no political questions. Hence, Nixon watched football on television as demonstrators stormed around the Pentagon. No economic records or social problems, and best of all, no tragic situations. In football, as in life, the spectator faces innumerable complications. But in football, all the action takes place within a clear and distinct framework and can be followed more or less with ease. The fast plays, the fakes, the great moments can be caught and savored thanks to slow motion replay. I had the ultimate situation once. We were sitting right below the press box, and it was Johnny Unitas and Tom Berkshire and Pat Summerall calling the game, and we could actually watch the game and just turn right around behind us and there they were sitting, and we could watch the replay. Some fans even bring their little Sony pop-ups, to watch the replays themselves. There are no irrational mysteries to bedevil the mind, which can effectively master the patterns unwinding before it. The spectator, like the eye of God, can scrutinize the same play from two or three different angles. History becomes transparent. The rest of the universe may be locked in the jaws of determinism, but in football, the charismatic principle is still present and potent. The course of play is seldom a one-way flow. Fumbles, interceptions, and blocked punts, among other things, can punctuate the game and turn it around. The long bomb is the most exciting coup de theater in sports, a revolutionary possibility ready to explode without warning. Finally, when the charisma is flowing, time itself can be overcome. By means of timeouts, running out of bounds, and incomplete forward passes, the clock can be made obedient to human wishes. In pro football, then, the spectator participates in a heightened form of existence. During the brief hours of the game, he sees the base matter of everyday life elevated, purified, clarified, and intensified. Idealized figures, stronger, swifter, more cunning than ordinary men, fight a bruising battle in a make-believe microcosm, the stadium as ideal universe. Football is a synthesis of illusion and reality. A good football game is real enough to involve the spectator, illusory enough to liberate him. It creates what Sartre called privileged moments, temporary and imaginary redemption. Okay. It's an interesting interpretation. I don't want to take too much time. I got about 2 hours more of this.
We'll pick up on that later.
Okay.
Foot-long hot dogs right there.
Yeah, really.
Okay. Well,
that's it. Well, what I really want to do is just dump on you tonight. But I want to say...
Please stay down. Sit down. They see this.
But I want to begin by saying that I'm not a spoil sport. When I play games against opponents, I really play hard to win, and I enjoy winning. I watch Sunday afternoon football, and I root for Minnesota, which if you live in Ohio, is really hard to do. I cheered passionately all the athletic teams of all the schools and institutions that I attended, and when I played hard. So, I don't mean to say any of the things that I'm saying as someone who's uninvolved, but at the same time, I guess there are a number of aspects, first of all, that bother me about the whole athletic enterprise. I wish it were as described, by Novak and so on, but some of the things that begin to bother me begin already with physical education instruction in schools. Most physical education instructors double as coaches, and as a matter of fact, what suffers is not the coaching, but the physical education. I don't want to generalize from our experience, our own experience, but I at least want to point to the things that I think are wrong with what's going on. We do not really try to help everybody achieve their potential in the athletic enterprise. We do not really try to help all people develop sound bodies. Physical education programs in schools frequently are designed to be little more than sessions in which the physical education instructors, whose real business is coaching, can scout their prospects for the team, which will meet later on in the afternoon, and rehearse and win. All of us who are spectators tend to reinforce this. We really don't ask our coaches to provide us with good spectacles of the kind that Erling was reading about. We ask our coaches to win, win, win. Who remembers, for example, that in a very celebrated game just a couple of years ago, Michigan massively outplayed Ohio for about 3 3/4 of the game, 3/4 and 3/4 of the third quarter, only to lose in about the last 2.5 minutes of the game to some crazy shenanigans that happen near the end. We do not really look for excellence. Every once in a while, friends of mine who our own faculty at Ohio State get me some tickets. And so I always sit in a strong Ohio State rooting section. But I like to cheer the good play. Wow. I mean, that is like using four-letter Anglo-Saxonisms in church on Sunday. And I remember the first time I did it, Michigan State was playing Ohio State. I have no interest in Michigan State winning, but they were really making the good plays. And as a matter of fact, that afternoon they beat Ohio State. So I would cheer the good play until I began to see that it wasn't really safe to do that and I might not emerge unscathed from that stadium. I stood up all alone and cheered that Minnesota player who ran 102 yards for a touchdown last September at Ohio State. Nobody else cheered, although Ohio State was winning about 42-0. Pardon? At any rate, the point is that our stated purposes for the athletic enterprise, to build sound bodies, et cetera, aren't really being carried out at all. Which makes an awful lot of hypocrisy out of the brotherhood of athletics, where we cheer sportsmanship and good plays, but actually are devoted almost exclusively to winning. That raises, I think, a bunch of serious questions, and it raises especially serious questions when I keep seeing on Sunday afternoon television the combination of religion and patriotism linked to the athletic enterprise. All the flag waving and praying and chaplains and great scorekeepers who are invoked solemnly at the beginning or somewhere in the game puts together a combination of things which really begins to say something. I keep asking, what kind of witness is going on when we can in Columbus turn out 15,000 people for Lutheran night at the stadium, you know? The Baptists do it too, you know, and everybody does, and everybody wins in this. Lutherans identify themselves with a very popular enterprise, the Columbus Clippers, and Lutheran Senior City gets a dollar per ticket. And so you can enjoy the game, placard Lutheranism all over the stadium and the city, because of course we get mentioned on late night television, and raise money for Lutheran Senior City at the same time. I mean, you know, you've got religion, sports, patriotism, a good thing, winning, God, everything, all lumped together. I keep asking, what would happen if we tried to have Lutheran night at the symphony sometime, you know? It wouldn't, first of all, it wouldn't work very well, and secondly, who would care, and thirdly, it wouldn't get on the news, and fourthly, nobody would make any money out of it. You know, I mean, when you start asking those kinds of questions, at least, I begin to get very, very concerned. It seems to me that we might, well, there are other things. The kind of athletic games that most of us really love are the kind you can't play very long. George Blanda can go along kicking field goals for umpteen years until, you know, he makes middle age almost seem never happening. But most of the athletic enterprises to which we devote vast amount of energy and resources don't really take us very far in life at all. You can't play them very long. If we really cared, I suppose, about the kinds of athletic enterprises which would be healthful for us, we would cultivate those kinds of athletics that a person could at least engage in for most of his life. I would think golf here, minus the carts, and tennis and bowling and so on ought to be much more healthy kinds of things to do. In addition to that, it seems to me that Christians at least ought to be interested maybe in those games in which we're playing against the game itself rather than against each other. it's much more fun to play against par on a golf course than to try to beat the people that you're playing with. In fact, it's fairly uncomfortable to try to beat the people you are with. Bowling, too, is another game in which you are bowling against the game itself rather than against other people, only incidentally, perhaps, against other people. You know, maybe, just maybe, Christians ought to have a value system which would express itself in other ways than whom you could beat on a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon. I think of this particularly when it comes to coaching and the whole sports enterprises at so-called church-related colleges. We fire coaches with the same kind of reckless abandon if they do not win at Lutheran colleges as we do at any secular college. And it's the alumni who breathe down an athletic director's neck to make sure that he has winning teams. We give scholarships to athletes. We think, you know, I keep thinking about this. When I went to Heidelberg University, nobody ever knew who carried the ball for dear old Heidelberg back in 1386 when it was founded. But it was interesting. You know, it was really interesting to note who the University of Heidelberg was known for. Famous statue in the city of Heidelberg is erected in memory of Bunsen, who gave us the Bunsen burner. When I think of Heidelberg University, I think of George Frederick Hegel, great philosopher, probably had a more profound influence on the 20th century than anybody else, and who taught for years at Heidelberg, who spawned both right and left dialectics and gave us Karl Marx. I think of the famous person, Philip Melanchthon, studied at and taught at Heidelberg, the Heidelberg Catechism, you know. But who thinks of the Nobel Prize winners at Notre Dame? You know, I mean, just how many of us even pay much attention to the fact that right now John Howard Yoder teaches at Notre Dame? I mean, we know who coaches there, right? Do you know how many Nobel Prize winners are at Ohio State? Not a one. I mean, we know Woody Hayes, right? Everybody in the world has heard of Woody Hayes, at least in the civilized world. But we do not know that right now at Ohio State in the pharmacy school there are researches going on that affect greatly the tolerance of medication that can be given between toxicity and therapeutic benefits for heart disease, or that Ohio State is right now probably the only place where they are very close to a breakthrough on a non-addictive alternative to heroin. And a good friend of mine is in charge of the research on this project. But we will never hear about this, you see, because all we know is Woody Hayes and an annual trip to the Rose Bowl. I keep asking what kinds of values this represents. I think that our values are warped and distorted. I do not think that Reggie Jackson is worth $1 million a year. I don't think anybody is. Tab Hunter? No, it isn't Tab Hunter. It's Catfish Hunter, whoever. Whatever they are, you know, I feel the same grotesque way about athletic salaries as I do about Johnny Carson's salary. It's ridiculous. It says a lot about not their worth, but our values, where we are willing to spend our money. That is what it really addresses. At least in the Middle Ages, where the knights fought each other, what was at stake was the other knight's horse and armor. I would like to have them play on Sunday afternoons for each other's salaries. It would serve them right. You lose! No salary. It goes to the other guy. It would keep salaries fairly low, possibly. Might increase the interest. I don't know.
Well, thanks, Walt. That should be enough of a clear presentation of some alternatives to chew on. So let's take a few minutes now, perhaps only 10.
15.
Or 15. And meet in groups of six or eight, just wherever you are, you can sort yourself out, although probably you'd like to talk with those you haven't talked with earlier.
Well.
And then we'll share some thoughts and ideas following that.
Everybody who was here participated. That's good. I mean, in this
one. That was full participation, at least in this sport, huh?
Really.
Well, what we'll try to do is just get a few brief comments from each of the groups to some of your choicest morsels, okay? and then take a brief break. Some of you may want to leave then, and then just following a minute or two break, then we'll open it up for general conversation. Why don't we begin up here on this level?
Why not?
The $2 seats up there. The last shall be first tonight.